Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode 346, recorded on September 15th of 2020. Today, we are going to be talking about Azure Autonomous Systems. On Teams with me, I have Sujit, our special guest Scott Scanfield, and myself, Cynthia. Before diving into the topic, why don't we go through a couple updates? Sujit, do you want to start us off?
I do. Thank you, Cynthia. So I've got three, there were quite a few updates this week, but I picked three of them that I thought were interesting to our listeners. First is the Azure Private Link service is now generally available in China. So I know this has been rolling out in many regions of the world, but was not yet available in China. So glad to see that's available there. Also, the Azure Pipelines now announces the general availability of the scale set agents. You know, what are scale set agents? These are like on-prem agents that you can deploy in your own environment to deploy VMs, right? So if you, it's part of your DevOps process, you got to spin up a few VMs. Typically, you could use Microsoft hosted agents, but if security is something that you know you want to control a little more tightly, you can use these scale set agents on-prem and then kick them off from Azure Pipeline. So kind of like what we do for build agents in the software development world, you could do the same thing for deploying your own servers now. And then finally, Azure Blob Storage. The replication system, the object replication, which we talked to the PM a while ago about this, but this is now generally available. And what this allows you to do is to say, okay, I have, you know, a blob storage in, let's say, East US, which I'm using as my primary, but I want it replicated to something in West US. So in case there's a failure, now you know exactly where to fail over to. It's your account. So you're obviously paying for two accounts, but you have full kind of control over that data that's flowing over. And you know, you can get that quick failover whenever you need it. Cynthia, what do you got?
I have one regarding the change of TLS certs for IoT Hub and a number of other IoT services on Azure. We have decided to change our CA, which is the certificate authorities for a lot of our certs, due to the fact that our current ones does not necessarily comply with all the requirements that we're looking for. And it is especially important if you or your customers are explicitly specifying a list of acceptable CAs. But if you're not, there has been a notification on your Service Health portal on additional information on what to expect in terms of the changes and when. But just something to keep in mind. And the other thing I also wanted to highlight is that Ignite is coming next week. And this time we are going virtual for the first time, and it is completely free. So if you're interested in learning about all the latest updates, you can go ahead and go to ak.ms/ignite, and you will be able to get to the site, register, and look at all the sessions.
That's a good reminder, Ignite, about Ignite, Cynthia. And just to clarify, so Ignite's more of our, I guess it's more infrastructure, IT kind of focus. Is that correct? As opposed to build, which was more dev focused?
Yes, but I think it's where we release a lot of our new products or new updates. Because I think that's like one of our timelines that the product group's working really hard towards, of releasing a bunch of new stuff. So there's probably going to be a lot of new stuff that we'll see out of Ignite.
Cool. Looking forward to that.
Awesome. And without further ado, we will turn it over to our special guest, Scott. Scott, can you introduce yourself to our listeners, what you do at Microsoft, and what is so cool about autonomous systems?
Hey, everyone. Sure. Cynthia and Suji, thanks for having me on. My name is Scott Stanfield, and I'm a principal PM on the autonomous systems team here at Microsoft. And this group came out through an acquisition that Microsoft made a couple of years ago of a company called Bonsai here in Berkeley, California. So we are, as of build, we are build of this past May, we are in Azure as a service for our customers under, you'll find us under Project Bonsai. But it's an unusual product. It's something that's meant for more industrial customers, specifically a different type of engineer, which I'd like to talk about. But anyway, thanks for having me on.
So Scott, how did you kind of get into this area? Was this always your passion? What kind of drove you to this particular part of the cloud?
Sure. Prior to joining Microsoft a couple of years ago, I was the CEO of a company with my wife that we founded in 97 called Vertigo. And so we have a lot of history in working with Microsoft and building projects through that. And then after selling that, I took a few years to build. My background is software engineering, and I'm a programmer. And I got to kind of go deep and on some hands-on around machine learning and came kind of out of that experience thinking, okay, this is some really great stuff, but how can software engineers, how can programmers apply what we know about data science and statistics, and which is basically CSV files. That's what we do, really, just wrangling CSV files. But what can we do to take what we know and help the physical world? So how can we collaborate with mechanical engineers or electrical engineers or physicists or geophysicists? What can we do to bring our skills to bear on complicated problems related to manufacturing lines or chemical process optimization, logistics, mechatronics, climate control? And really the guiding light for me is one number. It's 2.5 degrees Celsius. And what can we do as individuals, especially with a software background, what can we do to help mitigate the ongoing risks of climate change? And, you know, being here in California, I look outside the window and it's a little smoky right now. So these are things on our mind. But to be able to reach out from the bits into the physical world is fascinating. And it's something I've never done. I've never tinkered beyond just setting up a Raspberry Pi with a couple blinking LEDs. And now, to immerse myself in the world of engineering. And I like to say engineering with a capital E, like the folks that study and have to get tested and potentially to be a professional engineer, you have to apprentice for a very long amount of time. There's several tests you have to pass. But when you have human life at hand, you want people to have those skills. And I'm sure there are engineers listening to us now, they're probably thinking, wait a minute, Microsoft is even talking about mechanical engineering? Like what do we have to offer there? And that's when you say, Scott, why don't you tell me what we have to offer?
I mean, what's the collaboration? How does the cloud fit into all this? I guess that's the obvious question.
So it centers around, I'm gonna throw out a couple of things. One is reinforcement learning. And we have heard about reinforcement learning through the success of Go and, well, it really changed this game and how it's played. And it was using computation to solve and come up with novel strategies to play against humans. But it learned by playing itself. It learned through a simulation of the game of Go. The same thing can be applied to backgammon. Same thing can be applied to poker. We're seeing reinforcement learning in the gaming space, like with StarCraft, come up with novel solutions. And it works because you have a game that can be digitized and the rules can be inferred through trial and error. And the difference with reinforcement learning or machine teaching, which is our bigger goal, how do we teach machines to benefit us and to find novel solutions? You need a simulation of that. And if you have a simulation, how do you run it at scale in the cloud? And so the biggest source of simulation that's out there, aside from some of the free open source Atari games, you know, Lunar Lander, in the professional engineering world, our partners like AnyLogic, Ansys, the MathWorks, MATLAB, and Simulink, these are mechanical systems that exist that you can model an entire machine. And I don't mean something small like a bearing. You can model a wind farm. So not just a wind turbine, but in all the different components of it, but model down to just the degree of engineering detail that you can get down to build a mechanical, a digital twin of a simulation in the cloud. The problem is a lot of this is based on the horsepower of an engineer's workstation. So by taking that simulation and bundling it up and letting it run in the cloud, you can poke at it to try to find a better potential solution to a problem of optimizing throughput or increasing efficiency or yield or turning the windmill in the right direction, but only doing it if there's been some consistency set up ahead of time. Let me take a slightly different angle. Okay. So there's the world of, it's a very big, scary sounding word, but mechatronics. It's such a great word, mechatronics. And mechatronics is the, imagine the Venn diagram where you overlap mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, which is where the word comes from, computer science, and control theory. So it's the synthesis of computation to control physical things. And so you have sensors, so you can detect what's going on in the world. You have actuators, so you can affect what's going on. And then you have some kind of higher level control of what should I be doing. So think about the Boston Dynamics Spot robot or any kind of, what's the drone I'm looking at? Some of the flying drones. It's a great example of a control system and a control loop that brings to bear all these components really well. How do we take those specialized engineering projects and bring this world to the masses? Well, at least to the engineering audiences. And we have a solution. We have an approach. And so I'd like to give you an example. I'll give you two examples. Cruise control. I love this example as a simple control theory. Think about you're driving down, I don't know, we'll say, I'm trying to think, 80. Let's say we're going to Tahoe. We're going to Truckee. As long as we can avoid all the traffic getting through Sacramento, if anyone's in California, you know at some point you start to hit the foothills. And so let's say you set the cruise control for 70 miles an hour. I don't know what it is in kilometers. I know we're a global audience. I just haven't grokked that yet, the conversion. But you set it for 70 and you start to hit the foothills. So what happens if you don't do anything with the cruise control? The car will slow down. So let's say you want it to be 70 and you're being asked, Sujeet, how would you program this cruise control? So you would look, well, if it's set to 70 and I'm currently going 65 miles an hour, I've sensed that I've slowed down. Well, we want to close that gap, and that's an error that we want to minimize. And the error in this case is 5 miles an hour. So Sujeet, what do? You just slam on the accelerator as hard as you can until you get back to 70. But we know that's probably not going to be good, right? Because you're going to blow right through that 70 miles an hour. So what you just did, you applied what's called a bang-bang controller. So if you drop below a threshold, one of the simplest ways of controlling equipment is just to turn it on and then turn it off. So think of a thermostat in your house. Like if you want to turn on the heat because it's too cold, they're kind of dumb. It's especially if you have the old mercury switches. It'll just turn it on until it reaches the final temperature and then just shuts off. But it will coast beyond your desired set point. So now you start to think, well, what if what I really want to do is to close that gap as quickly as possible, but not overshoot it? That's now you have two things you're trying to optimize for. Close the gap quickly, but don't overshoot 70 miles an hour to where you then have to let go of the gas and then accelerate to come back up. And there's an algorithm that it took me a while to understand, and now I feel like I see it everywhere. It's the PID controller. And so anyone with a mechanical electrical background or control theory, they'll know this. There's a report from Honeywell that said it's the algorithm used in over 90% of industrial controllers today. It's the proportional integral derivative function to control to finely tune this feedback system to make your cruise control get back to that spot as quickly as possible. So you follow me? It seems like a simple idea. And yeah. It took me a while to grok it because I'm a programmer. I'm like, I hate to admit, but we just don't do integrals.
And are you saying now that this would form the basis of a simulation then?
Well,
is that where you were going?
Start to kind of build up from those parts. So, right. So from the control perspective, you have these simultaneous goals. And what's the best way to achieve it? So I have this robot that I've been working on for a long time because I'm thinking with mechanical systems, how do you demonstrate, how do you take this world of simulation and in the cloud, but make it real for people so you can see it and play with it. So I built this robot called Project Moab. And it's basically a glass plate that I'm showing on the screen, which I'm sure looks great for your audio listeners. But just imagine, it's like the size of a dinner plate, and it's clear acrylic, and there's a little ping pong ball. And as a human, I can hold on one hand and look at it and keep it balanced in the middle. So if we had three plates, we could have a little contest, see who can keep the ball. So you can keep the ball in the middle longest. And so like the goal of not accelerating past 70 miles an hour, but getting to that set point quickly, how do I balance these two goals simultaneously? And that's through classic control theory. And now just keeping this ball in the middle of this plate is a classic problem in mechanical engineering. If you're a second-year college student, you've probably done something like this. And there's examples of this all over the web. I wanted to build that, this little robot with, let me unplug it. Again, it's got, imagine a Raspberry Pi with three servos and little arms that extend with a camera in the middle that's looking up. So instead of as a human with two eyes of stereo vision, I now have one eye and it's pointing up, which it turns out it's kind of a problem because you're looking in lights all the time. So the computer vision algorithm to recognize the ball is difficult. But I have to take that and then use the servos to move the ball to the middle. If you're an engineer, mechanical engineer, you can control this quickly. There's a path to making this happen. But I'm not a mechanical engineer. I'm not an electrical engineer. I'm a programmer. And this is a fairly simple problem. So what you'd like is to have a simulation of MOAB, which we have. We have a graphic simulation of it that you can run in Azure and let it fail until it succeeds. You can set up with four lines of code. You essentially document your interface. You document saying, this is the state of the system that I can infer at any time. And for us, we care about where the ping pong ball is relative to the center. We care about how fast it's going. And given those four bits of information, X and Y, and the X dot, or the first derivative, which would be the velocity, all I need to know is with this little Xbox-style joystick, do I pitch forward and back, or roll left and right? That's it. Four inputs, two outputs, and there's a black box in the middle that's currently solved with a PID controller. We also can solve it with a trained brain that doesn't know anything about the system. It's just, you know, I've tested this with like seven-year-olds. They can balance it after three tries. It takes the computer maybe 100,000 tries, maybe 200,000 tries to find the answer. But it does in maybe 20 minutes, and then you download the Docker container to the Raspberry Pi and run it. So what I've done, I've taken a simulation of some mechanical system, ran it in the cloud where I have lots of compute power, found a solution to multiple simultaneous goals, and it gives me a Docker container with a, underneath the covers, there's like a REST interface. So I send it my state information, X and Y, and the velocity of the ball, and it returns the position, the pitch I should roll in. Now, as long as my simulation is a close approximation of reality, and all simulations are guesses, then I get good behavior. And I can show you, but it wouldn't really translate. But the viewers can go to aka.ms/moab to see it. And then from there, go explore Banzai, aka.ms/Banzai, to learn more about where we're taking this. So I learned by example. I learned by code, like the Pubs database, which is the old school, and then Northwind's database. And my company built some early ASP.NET web samples and .NET Nuke and things like that goes back. I learned by seeing it working. And I kind of needed to see this working for me to know, can I take these skills I've developed as an engineer, a programmer, but learn to work with engineers to solve these fascinating real world problems.
That is so cool.
I studied computer engineering and I did have to take a control theory class. Oh. And we did exactly a cruise control with like a haptic feedback of how do you decide when you want to switch lanes, like how fast or slow do you go. Wow. So I'm totally with you on the part of like, I like to see things versus just everything on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you mentioned earlier that you wanted to bring this to the engineers with a capital E. Can you talk about in terms of like machine teaching, and since it seems like it's so much easier for a human to do such thing as balancing the ball, versus the computer algorithm having to go through so many times, like how does that translate into people with expertise or engineers with expertise into something that we can replicate onto an algorithm?
Yeah, and they might be thinking, this is kind of a state space problem where we operate this thing every, it's 30 hertz. So it's reading the camera at at a pretty good clip and making a pretty simple adjustment. And as a human, we can do that. But this is just the beginning. I mean, imagine a much more complex multidimensional problem with multiple outputs, with multiple goals, like multiple. It's not just, remember, I'm trying to keep the ball in the middle without it falling off. And I didn't really say how to articulate that. And so there's this key four or five lines of Inkling code, which is this descriptive language of how to solve it. You can start to extrapolate out to a much more complex space. Like if you're trying to do a thin film deposit of zinc on stainless steel, on steel, not stainless, but steel to create galvanized steel, you need to deposit that precious zinc at a very small layer between 1 and 2 microns as it's being made in a giant mill as it's zipping through the manufacturing process. Or like my cousin runs a bread factory company. And I'll never forget watching these little buns being made and they're being split on the top with a jet of water. So imagine like a KFC, maybe it's Burger King, some kind of split top butter bun. And that split comes from a jet of water. It's brilliant. It's like it's just enough to cut the dough. And then it moves forward to a sesame seed thing. Like it sprinkles sesame seeds on. So the question is, how much sesame seeds do you put on? It turns out that's the most expensive ingredient. So they capture the sesame seeds at the bottom and they reuse them. So someone, some engineer, had to decide how big to make that opening and how often do we let it go. And so these decisions are everywhere. And some of them have simple, well, I wouldn't say simple, but well-known solutions. And it gets more complex when you add other sensors like computer vision to the problem or simulations that are just not solvable by a human because the state space is too complex. So I like to kind of work from the bottom up. But as we look top down in the space of like continuous process control or what is that? What is chemical process optimization? You know, in the world of chemical engineering, a lot of it is thermodynamics and managing heat in the production of things like cling wrap or plastic pellets or, you know, just the yield of like Clorox, for example, you know, a bleach solution. Those are really complex processes, but they have simulations. And there are a lot of simulations out there. Now, I personally grew up on SimCity. The very first simulation I ever ran was an Atari 800, and it was called Scram. And it was a nuclear power simulation. You literally, as a kid, I was my first video games. It's super boring, but you had to simulate. You had this like control dashboard and you had to make tweaks to pumps that were failing. And you had to decide what humans to send out to fix the pumps. And some of them would die, of course, because it's a video game. But so these simulations are everywhere. And if we can bring the power of the computation we have in the cloud, we can start to turn these complex robotics-style processes into software problems that we can find new and novel solutions to really benefit us.
How flexible is the MOAB that we have in Azure or in the Banzai system? Like, can it really solve all the world's problems, or is there like some kind of limit?
It's just a demo. it's the simplest complex problem, or it's a complex problem that's simple enough to kind of read through the code and understand. And as we're speaking, I'm literally today working with the open source team at Microsoft, getting the repo set up at github.com/Microsoft/. Well, you can go to MOAB now to see the website, but the source code, I've just completed all the review and got everything dialed in to where you can, if you are lucky to get one of these units, because there's not many right now, as we kind of get through this first process, you would learn how to provision a Raspberry Pi. And by the way, I wouldn't use Debian. No offense, but you know, use a Raspberry Pi to control a big mechanical system that could kill you if you didn't do it right. Because you know, this is not a real-time operating system, but it's something approachable, and it was inexpensive. So with some off-the-shelf servos, a Raspberry Pi, even the Raspberry Pi camera itself, it's mostly dealing with the power and the joystick, trying to figure out how to make it so you can control it by hand. But that's just, it's just a way to get people to understand what the bigger picture and opportunity is. And we're on Azure.
Awesome. That's really cool. What do you think are the next kind of steps that you're going to take? Like, I know there's stuff that you probably cannot announce here, but anything you think that our listeners can know? right now?
Yes. One of the reasons I did this project is because it looks cool, like it's a physically interesting thing. I'm just as interested in another type of chemical or entropy problem just around heaters. And it looks really boring, but HVAC, I can talk a lot about HVAC because I have a faulty refrigerator with a compressor that just gives me fits and starts. But just the energy cycle of refrigeration is fascinating, and it's a really complex problem. It's something that you should take every modern refrigerator, like if you really go inside to understand how it's controlled through pressure and not temperature, and there's so many variables. All I want to do is keep my food cold. Now, the house, I have this unusual old Victorian home. The previous owner built the refrigerator from scratch, the refrigeration unit itself. The refrigerator box, the compressor is from the 70s. And it just recently started to develop a leak. And so I've had to learn all this. As I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, I know what I want. What I want is my food to not spoil. Okay. And then, but my senses are, I have Bluetooth temperature sensors. I have a pressure valve to turn on the compressor. And it's like this Azure IoT thing just waiting to happen. Like, I know what I want, but this is the information I get. I just don't want it to freeze over. There's so many things that can happen with a refrigerator. It's just an industrial chiller unit. It's just fascinating. It's just new stuff, right? I mean, I'm a programmer, basically. I like bash scripting. I still use a terminal and VI. But to be able to drop in and have something you can contribute to another endeavor around something in engineering is just, it's been a blast. So I want to do more in that space. You're going to hear more over the next probably the next 6 months where we're going in specific industry verticals to really take this skill out there. But for the latent engineers, capital E engineers, that are listening to the broadcast, check us out. We're just getting started. You'll hear more about this. I wish we could be in person. I've been at the last two Ignites, and I definitely miss being out and miss everyone. And I hope to see you at one of these shows in person soon.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.